This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, can't tell if language is laughing or crying. After yet another spell of the British press and politicians using very dehumanising and derogatory rhetoric about migrants, I felt it necessary to go back to the Away Team episode of The Allusionist about the language of migration. It originally went out in early 2017, but it is never not relevant, sadly. And there is a chunk of new material in The Mini-Allusionist, so stick around right till the end to hear that. On with the show.
Recognizing someone's humanity is crucial. Calling someone a migrant, calling someone a, you know, asylum seeker, calling them a refugee, these are official categories. But in many ways, depending on how they're used, they can change and they can become more negative. And they also preference how officials are sorting them over their very basic humanity.
This is Dr. Emma Bryant, a lecturer and researcher in journalism studies.
I'm a specialist in propaganda and political communication and the representation of migration and security and inequality in the media. The category of migrant is one that embraces a lot of different groups. This is simply just somebody who is moving from one place to another, and that might be internally within a country, or it might be between countries.
What does immigrant mean?
Immigrant is relational, so it's somebody who's coming into the country. So when the British media is talking about immigrants, they're talking about people coming into Britain. When the French media is talking about immigrants, they're talking about people coming into France. Emigrant means people leaving. So, I mean, people who migrate from Britain to France or to anywhere are emigrating to that country. So it's just about the direction of travel, basically.
And what's the distinction between asylum seeker and refugee?
A refugee is somebody who, according to the Refugee Convention, is fleeing war and persecution, torture, this kind of thing, political oppression. And that is a category they have to have proved that they are in that position. So somebody who is trying to become a refugee is called an asylum seeker. So they haven't had their case heard yet. And once their application has been heard, then if it's heard successfully and it's not rejected, then they become a refugee. And they are entitled to be treated the same as any other citizen in the country. So they should be entitled to everything another citizen would get. These kinds of categories get used very indistinctly, and I think there's an awful lot of like misunderstanding.
For many years, Emma Bryant has been studying how the media portrays migration. And in the British press, certainly, there's a tendency to use the relevant vocabulary inaccurately. And whether intentional or not, this misuse can cause a lot of damage.
All of these terms are becoming pejorative, where they once were more neutral. We hardly found anybody in our sample who was referred to as a refugee. We even found somebody who was referred to as a former asylum seeker. They were a refugee. They had had their asylum case heard and they had won their refugee status, but they got referred to as a former asylum seeker because asylum seeker becomes, it delegitimates them. And it's a negative category in the media. These categories have become more and more negative. Even refugee, which you hear more often now after the refugee crisis, it has become a very negative term. And migrant too, even though it was once neutral, has become more negative.
In 2016, the Daily Mail had front page headlines about migrants 56 times, the Daily Express 70 times. Whenever I looked at a shelf of our tabloids, I saw screaming in big block capitals, frequently accompanied by misleading information and vastly overinflated numbers, which were sometimes later corrected in a retraction in far tinier print than the original headline. Migrants seized every 6 minutes. Britain's asylum seeker madness. Illegal migrants flooding into EU. Migrants keep pouring into EU. Migrants pay just £100 to invade Britain. Migrant mothers cost NHS £1.3 billion. Migrant crisis will cost £20 billion. The invaders. Cover up over migrants sneaking into the UK. Britain faces migrant disaster. Britain faces new migrant crisis. We can't stop new migrant surge. We can't stop migrants. Migrant crisis getting worse. No end to migrant crisis. Migrant madness. So-called refugees. That one was actually a headline in the Mail on the 3rd of February 1900. Casting aspersions on migrants is not a recent preoccupation for them.
So the negative associations with these categories really do cloud the way we analyse the facts. The important takeaway is that including as much of the context of why people are travelling and trying to see them as human beings who are affected by these social and economic pressures and political transitions that are taking place around the world is the key issue.
Too bad, Emma, that the tabloids don't seem so inclined to shout indignantly about how climate change or war cause displacement of humans. They also don't tend to use these sorts of terms about Brits abroad.
Actually, people who are British, white Brits especially, who are going to live in Spain or going to live in Saudi Arabia and working for the oil industry or the, you know, moving to Australia or whatever, they refer to themselves and are often referred to by the media as expats.
Expatriate, noun, one who chooses to live abroad. Censor tested in 1902, prior meaning, one who has been banished, from French expatrié, derived from Latin ex, out of, and patria, native country. Unlike immigrant and asylum seeker and refugee, expat is a word that has become more benign with time.
Expatriates. Now, they're emigrants. They're immigrants to the countries that they have gone to. But immigrant tends to be only applied when it's dealing with people we don't like. So it tends to be never us. You know, it's others. So it tends to be often applied to people with a different skin colour, people who we see as economically less well off, who might be coming for reasons we don't like, and so on. People from other parts of the world are never referred to as expats. And frequently the term illegal gets used and bandied around when nothing illegal has happened. So in relation to immigrant, asylum seeker, and so on, they will frequently prefix that with bogus or illegal. And that should never be happening because these people are not illegal. People cannot be illegal anyway. Sometimes their actions can be illegal, and that's another matter. But the way that these terms get used, they get associated with these negative labels, and it clouds the way that we see those terms.
Be vigilant for the linguistic tendencies that steer one's interpretation of information regarding the international movement of human beings. One pernicious trend is to describe a number of refugees or migrants as a swarm or flood.
Flooding, deluge, waves of immigrants and so on, yeah. Numbers are used to conflate different categories, but also they use an awful lot of rhetoric that amplifies the effect and makes the incoming migrants sound really scary and like they are, you know, bringing disaster with them. Now that's, it's very evocative language, and it amplifies the sense of fear of them arriving, of course.
And this language of amassed creatures or of nature's force, when used to describe people, makes them seem not like individuals, not even humans at all.
Talking about people as cockroaches and so on, rats, vermin, parasites, leeches, you know, all of this kind of imagery dehumanizes people. And it's never applied to white people. It's always kind of been having this racial undertone.
On the one hand, you have this sort of language that strips away agency and like the right to a body or the right to having a physical presence in the world, because you become this swarm, this faceless swarm. You're not a separate entity yourself. And then, you know, when people are quite carelessly lumped in as an asylum seeker, everyone has the right to seek asylum. Or a refugee or even an immigrant. Like, these words don't have negative connotations. So you have to wonder where the negative connotations or the sort of the laden burdens around these words, where they're coming from. I'm Nikesh Shukla. I'm an author and the editor of The Good Immigrant.
The Good Immigrant is a collection of essays about race, immigration, and being descended from immigrants. The writers are top-notch, and the book has won a bunch of awards. Read it. Are you an immigrant?
No, I'm a child of an immigrant. My mum and dad were immigrants to this country, but I think being brown, decisions are made about me as I walk about.
Where are you from? No, where are you really from?
And when people ask me, where am I from? No, where are you really from? I always just tell them I'm from London, because the truth is much more complex than they would be able to understand.
And also much more simple than they've assumed.
Yeah, exactly. But when someone says, no, where are you from? No, where are you really from? What they're saying is, where are your parents from? And what they want you to say is, oh, my parents are Indian, but neither of my parents are. So it's not an easy answer. My dad was born in Kenya. And my mum was born in Yemen. Neither of them ever lived in India. If I went to India, where I'm third generation, I feel so far removed from that. Dad's Kenyan in the same way that I'm British. You know, my mum is Middle Eastern in the same way that I'm British. We're all British Asian, but where are we really from? Who knows?
My dad's from South Africa, but both of his parents are Lithuanian. So he's not really from South Africa, but he's never been to Lithuania. So where are we from? However, I don't get lumped in with the kind of poisonous rhetoric that is now characterising our political debates. So it's not really all about the movement of human beings, is it?
No, it's about the colour of your skin and the accent you speak in. At what point do we become British? Like, what does British even mean?
What does British even mean? To me, it is encapsulated by the English language, this untidy, idiosyncratic, fascinating hodgepodge that bears the influence of multiple invasions and Britain's colonialisation and foreign policy. Take out the words Britain imported, borrowed or stole from countries across the world. Assassin, alcohol, shampoo, gingham, amok, juggernaut, thug. Take out the French that arrived with the Normans in 1066. Justice, marriage, instrument, parliament, religion, tax. Take out the Scandinavian Egg, words sky, that mark the Vikings' multiple skull, incursions for nearly cake, 300 years anger, before the Normans took
Thursday,
over. Take out the Germanic words
water,
that meat, landed around 500 AD when the king, Angles invaded,
bird,
followed by the think, Saxons and the
death,
Jutes.
Dog.
Take out the Latin that proliferated during Norman rule, but had been introduced here a millennium before that, when the Romans invaded and stuck around for nearly 500 years, and brought Greek with them too. Of course, if you lose the influence of those classical languages, you lose at least 60% of modern English, plus most scientific and technological vocabulary. Oh, and the word Britain itself. Take all of that away. And what's left? Pocket lint. In this episode, you heard from Emma Bryant and Nikesh Shukla. Emma Bryant's book Bad News for Refugees is a years-long study of the political, economic and environmental context of migration and how migration has been treated in the media and in politics. More recently, she's been working on mapping the influence of Cambridge Analytica on political campaigns. Find out more about that at propagandamachine.tech. Nikesh Shukla is the editor of the Good Immigrant Collections of Essays and the author of books including The Boxer, The One Who Wrote Destiny, and What is Race? Who are Racists? Why Does Skin Colour Matter? And Other Big Questions. Find him at nikesh-shukla.com, and I'll link to Nikesh and Emma's work at theillusionist.org/migration2020. And coming up in today's mini-illusionist, Nikesh and I contemplate the term political correctness. So it always has felt like it has failed as a term, because it's really just pointed out that whatever language is being used in the context of political correctness is just a thinly veiled bit of hate speak.
Yeah, it's the I'm not racist, but...
But what should it actually mean and be used for?
you know, looking back on it now, it was basically saying just, you know, be mindful of not saying all the racist things that you really think or the hateful things that you really, really think. When actually what it was trying to do was say, just be mindful that people have different opinions to you, and, you know, be sensitive to the fact that not everyone is the same as you. And I think that requires a degree of empathy that a lot of people just seem to not want to think about.
A brief history of the term political correctness. Its earliest known appearance was in 1793 in the US Supreme Court's first big case, Chisholm versus Georgia. Alexander Chisholm was suing the state of Georgia. The case was ruled in his favour. And in the judgment, there was some musing over the nature of sovereignty, the role of governance, the role of the people being governed. It said, the states, rather than the people for whose sakes the states exist, are frequently the objects which attract and arrest our principal attention. The judgment argues that this has crept into politics and the vernacular, using the example of a toast. The United States, instead of the people of the United States, is the toast given. This is not politically correct. The toast is meant to present to view the first great object in the Union. It presents only the second. It presents only the artificial person instead of the natural persons who spoke it into existence. So the political correctness there was the aspiration to an acknowledgement that the United States as an entity is composed of its people rather than is an entity itself. In that context, it's not being used in the political correctness gone mad sense that is all too familiar now. Nor did it have that meaning yet in its next big moment in the 1930s and 40s in Russia, where describing someone's actions as politically correct could be praise or disapproval. It meant they had acted in line with Communist Party principles, regardless of their own opinions or ethics. By 1970, liberal movements in the USA had borrowed this, partly to use as a compliment for people who supported, say, the civil rights movement, but also, sometimes a bit jokingly, about members of their own who were too on message. And now we know where this went.
It quickly became, political correctness gone mad. Like, it was very quick turnaround for that term to be subverted into the negative version of its intent, which was just be mindful, be nice, be inclusive. Asking people to be politically correct is not the same as censoring you. It's just asking you to be mindful.
So maybe the terminology is part of the problem, because politically seems like it's removed from everyday experience, and correctness seems like an externally imposed standard.
Yeah, I think the term itself is really messy. I don't necessarily like it. But what I think is quite interesting in terms of the terminology, like the terminology around all of this is messy and ridiculous. You know, when you think about the journey of the ethnic minority, you know, in the 80s we were all black, and then in the 90s we became more ethnic minorities. And then we became minority ethnic for a very short period of time. And then we became black and minority ethnic. And then we became black Asian and minority ethnic. And then even that isn't fully inclusive. You know, when you're talking about black Asian and minority ethnic, are you just talking about South Asia, or are you including East Asia and Southeast Asia as well? And also, you know, within BAME, there are communities that are white. And I think that's probably why there's been a move by people of colour to start to self-define as people of colour, because, you know, our lived experience is a particular one. And even within being a person of colour, you're very specifically a non-black person of colour, because being black is a very specific experience that's very different to being like Asian or being brown or what have you. So, I mean, the semantics of labeling is really difficult. And ultimately, like, we can only self-define. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I don't know what the answer is, but I've started to refer to myself as a person of colour, which for me feels right for this time. But, you know, being a nuanced individual, my feelings might change in years to come.
Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is choir. Noun. Definition 1. Four sheets of paper or parchment folded to form eight leaves, as in medieval manuscripts. Definition 2. Any collection of leaves one within another in a manuscript or book. Definition 3. 25, formerly 24, sheets of paper. 1/20th, of a ream. Try using it in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman. The music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com. Communicate with me at Allusionist Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can find every episode of the show, along with extra material and the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, at theallusionist.org.